Welcome back to Insight on CAP Radio. I'm Beth Ruriak. In conversation about earthquakes, we look to Southern California for what's someday supposed to be the big one. However, a fault line off the northern coast of Washington State, Oregon, and California prompted an article in The New Yorker by Catherine Schultz. It was titled, "The Really Big One." She interviewed a paleoseismologist from Oregon State University who studies ancient quakes. His name is Dr. Chris Goldfinger, and he joined us by phone on Insight in July of 2015. Dr. Goldfinger described the location of this recently discovered Cascadia fault line.
At the far north end of the San Andreas Fault is a place called Cape Mendocino, so in Northern California, and it runs there for about 1,000 kilometers, 700 miles or so, up to about the middle of Vancouver Island, British Columbia.
The other part of the name, subduction zone, is a tectonic plate phrase, and I'm going to start with my hands flat on the desk in front of me, and then I'll turn my elbows outward so my fingers are pointing at each other. Now, will you take me through what's happening in the subduction zone?
Okay. So, it's a little harder to do on the radio. So if you take your left hand and shove the fingers of it under the fingers of your right hand, then you're basically subducting or shoving underneath one plate underneath the other. When they get stuck, what you find is the knuckles of your right hand will start to bulge upward. Imagine your two hands kind of stuck together but still moving together. And they'll bulge up, and eventually they'll slip, and your fingers will kind of lurch forward a bit. And that's essentially what happens in a subduction zone earthquake.
And that lurch is what the big moment would be, right?
Yeah, that's right. That converging of the two plates and subducting of one underneath the other will go on from somewhere between 200 and 1,000 years, storing up plate motion that could amount to anywhere from 5 or 6 meters to as much as 40 meters that would be stored up and released all at once in the earthquake.
And the magnitude of, again, I'll call it the lurch as you referenced it, could be bigger than what potentially would happen on the San Andreas, if I understand your research correctly.
Yeah, that's right. The San Andreas Fault is another type of plate boundary. It's essentially a vertical fault. And so when you go down about 20 kilometers in the earth, you start to reach temperatures that are too hot to support what we call brittle failure, that is what generates earthquakes. And it starts to slide and slip more like taffy, something plastic. And so the fact that the fault's vertical limits its width to about 20 to 25 kilometers. But a subduction zone is one plate going underneath the other at a very low angle. So there's a lot of surface area before you get deep enough that it can't fail brittlely anymore. And that's why they're that much bigger, because earthquake magnitude is just a function of surface area. So we have a fault in Cascadia that might be about 100 kilometers wide, 1,000 kilometers long, and it might slip as much as 40 meters. And so those type of earthquakes like we had in Sumatra and Japan and we're expecting in Cascadia are in the 9 range or a little bit above. They can be smaller as well. But a San Andreas earthquake like 1906 is thought to max out at about 8.0.
How recently was this fault line, the Cascadia, discovered?
It's been known for a long time. In fact, it was one of the subduction zones that was first identified when plate tectonics first came into existence in the early 1960s. But the odd thing about Cascadia was that it didn't seem to have any earthquakes, and all other subduction zones did. In fact, that was one of the main observations in plate tectonics. And so it's been an enigma ever since. And about 1984 or so, a Canadian geologist named John Adams was one of the first to point out potential evidence for subduction zone earthquakes in the form of submarine landslides. And then a few years later, Brian Atwater became very well known for discovering onshore evidence of tsunami deposits and subsided coastlines and so forth. So the paradigm went from, we're not sure what's going on here, to essentially, we have a very large, maybe M9 producer of earthquakes.
We've posted a link to show some of the active tectonics and the seafloor mapping, which is what your team has been involved in. But I think what really shook up, so to speak, a lot of people in this article is that it was stated that the odds of this big Cascadia earthquake happening in the next 50 years are roughly 1 in 3. It seems that the probability is really high. And as I've listened to you talk, even over the last 5 years, it seems like the sureness about that probability has gone up as your research has grown.
It has. And it's not just me, though. There are about a score of people or so working on this problem for the last 25 years. Initially, the first work that was done by Brian Atwater in Washington indicated a rate of once about every 500 years, you know, on average. And so that translates into a probability of roughly 10 to 15% in 50 years. And so many of the early publications focused on that. And then as knowledge of Cascadia has grown, we found that there are earthquakes of different sizes and earthquakes of different lengths up and down the subduction zone. And so the probability depends on where you are. So in Washington, it's relatively modest, 10 to 15%. But in Northern California and southernmost Oregon, it's as much as 37%. And so that's where the 1 in 3 number comes from.
What would happen then in the really big one along this fault? And let's take that area, Northern California, Southern Oregon.
We have earthquakes that run the full length of the subduction zone. Those are likely to be upper 8s and 9s. And we have smaller ones, which could be down as low as magnitude 8, 8.5, which is still a gigantic earthquake, but the magnitude isn't quite as high as the full one. But for people who live along Northern California and Humboldt County and so forth and southernmost Oregon, it won't make much difference whether the Washington part goes off or not. It'll still be, you know, a very big earthquake. The tsunami will be much like the one in Japan. And ground motions, ground shaking, will probably last on the order of 3 minutes or so to as much as, potentially as much as 5 minutes.
So much of this will happen suddenly in a, 4 to 6 minute window. And then after that, the shaking will set off landslides. There will be this movement of the ground that seems like liquefaction. And then all kinds of things like pipe failures, dam breaches, hazardous spills. So in that short amount of time, I think the only hope people have is an early warning system. Is there anything like that in the Upper Northwest?
There's a nascent system. John Vidali at University of Washington is working on one. He's got it, sort of beta version of that working for just the scientists that were working on it. But no, there isn't an operational system yet. And so that would be a big help for sure. The other thing that's going to help a lot, though, is the fact that you might have an early warning would help for situations where you need to shut something down quickly, you know, an operating train or a power plant or operating rooms where you might, you know, suddenly go dark. But really the bigger problem that we face here in my mind is that we just have, you know, a number of major cities that have not been constructed where this has even been considered at all. And so early warning won't actually help in those cases for the most part. What we really need is sustained effort at retrofitting that's going to take many decades. Once we get there, a warning system will be much more effective and useful, I think. We should do both, of course, but that's where the priority is.
The New Yorker writer has a few lines that I think speak directly to what you're saying. She writes, "This problem is bidirectional. The Cascadia subduction zone remained hidden from us for so long because we couldn't see deep enough into the past. It poses a danger to us today because we've not thought deeply enough about the future." It sounds like you would agree with that statement.
One of the things that always attracted me to geology is you can look at the landforms around you and you can see the past. And if you can do that, then you can look into the future and see what's going to happen. And usually it's not as scary as this, but sometimes it is. And we've had very recent demonstrations in Sumatra in 2004 and in Tohoku in 2011 of exactly what this looks like when you have a magnitude 9 earthquake. First of all, an undeveloped country, and there was the loss of life was something like 250,000 people. And then again in Japan, which is the best prepared country in the world, and the loss of life was an order of magnitude smaller. So we've had about as many teachable moments as we're likely to have. And now at this point, we're probably better prepared in terms of knowing what's going to happen than, you know, any major subduction zone in the world. But the trick is, what are we going to do about it?
There's a description in The New Yorker about your experience in that 2011 earthquake and then tsunami in Japan. Do you have a second hand on your watch? Because it seems that earthquake measurement, for everyone who knows anything about it, has a lot to do with time.
Yes, it's all about time. And when we had our earthquake, we'd already had two earthquakes earlier in the week. And they're over so fast that smaller earthquakes and are over so fast that your mind is just catching up with what's happening by the time it ends. In this case, though, the subduction earthquake started. We fully expected it to stop after a few seconds, and when it didn't, we then looked at our watches and wanted to know how long it was going to go, and fully expecting it to stop within 30 seconds to a minute, When we got to the first minute, though, it didn't stop, and we knew we were into a big earthquake. And so Catherine writes about that, and we all were looking at each other, realizing as we went into the second minute and then to the third minute that we were seeing a paradigm change happening in real time, because Northeast Japan was not expected to have an earthquake of magnitude 9, which lasts roughly 3 to 4 minutes.
Out of curiosity, have you seen the movie San Andreas, or will you see it?
I have seen it. It was great fun.
And that's what you call it really is fun. Was there anything in there that you thought was valid for people to walk away with and be aware of?
Not very much, no. It was an entertainment. I'm from the Bay Area myself, and I wondered if people were actually became concerned about a tsunami knocking out the Golden Gate Bridge. The San Andreas Fault is very, very, very unlikely to generate any tsunami at all because it's a strike-slip fault. That is, the blocks move side by side, and it doesn't move very much water, so that won't happen.
The combination, though, of that movie and the New Yorker article and speaking to the reality that on the West Coast there is the potential for these very big events makes me wonder, are you in the reality out here that you're likely going to be caught in either a very big disaster up there or, when you're visiting the Bay Area, something down here?
Well, that's a possibility. I mean, that is life on the West Coast. I grew up in Palo Alto, actually, and my grandma lived in Daly City, right where the San Andreas Fault comes ashore, and I used to like to walk down to the end of her block and look down at it. And, you know, we're used to living on a relatively static Earth where the Earth doesn't give us much trouble, and we go about our lives. But as geologists, you know, unfortunately, we have the sort of unfortunate vision of being able to see what's going to happen. It is troublesome. I see places that I love, both in San Francisco and up here, that are likely to be destroyed, and that's not that pleasant of a thought.
That was Oregon State University paleoseismologist Dr. Chris Goldfinger in July of 2015. You can find a link to our original longer conversation at capradio.org/insight. This is Insight on Cap Radio.